The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm pleased to be here. Natalie Diaz won the American Book Award for her debut collection, When My Brother Was an Aztec. Her sophomore collection, Post-Colonial Love Poem, was a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award. Of the numerous glowing reviews for this collection, this one from Louise Erdrich is my favorite. With tenacious wit, ardor, and something I can only call magnificence, Diaz speaks of the consuming need we have for one another. This is a book for any time, but especially a book for this time. These days, and who knows for how long, we can only touch a trusted small number of people. Diaz brings depth and resonance to the fact that this has always been so. A former Women of the World Poetry Slam champion, Denise Froman has performed on national and international stages from the Apollo to the Obama White House and more than 200 colleges and universities. Her work focuses on identity, lineage, challenging traditional ideas of power, and celebrating the parts of ourselves deemed unworthy. A former program director at the Philly Youth Poetry Movement, she worked to create safe spaces for Philadelphia teens to discover the power of their voices. And I am going to disappear and first welcome Denise to the screen.
Thank you so much for that generous introduction. Thank you so much to the Free Library for having me. And of course, to Natalie for letting me join this event as we celebrate Post-Colonial Love Poem. Natalie is just a tremendous writer, one of my favorite writers. I've so enjoyed spending time devouring this collection, and I can't wait to hear her read these poems later. A collection that is just really exploring the tension between the estranged and the beloved. And Natalie's imagination is always running wild and free, and the language is so delicious. But in every poem, there is remembrance as well as reckoning. And the intimacy of Natalie's language is something that I am drawn to over and over again, that pulls me in. And so just deep gratitude, gracias a todos and gracias to Natalie. I'm going to read a couple of poems from a manuscript in progress. This first poem in a way reminds me, I was rereading Post-Colonial and it made me think of Natalie's They Don't Love You Like I Love You. This first poem that I'm going to read is called Doña Teresa and the Chicken. This was first an attempt to excavate a memory from my childhood visiting PR in the summer, Puerto Rico, where my mom was born. We used to visit in the summer. And I remember being really, really young and watching my abuela prepare dinner, by which I mean I saw her kill a chicken with her bare hands, which is something very traditional that happens on the island. But it is a memory that I've never been able to forget. And so this poem, you know, really began as an excavation of a memory without knowing what that memory was doing there, but quickly became an attempt to trace the lineage of grief in my family, grief, a feeling that unfortunately we all know too well, especially in this past year. I come from women who feel too much to feel too much. My mother, my abuela, these are not women who had the luxury of growing up with soft hands. These are not women who will sit you down and have heart to hearts. These are women who I think were trying to prepare me for a world that may not love me back. And so this poem is for them. Doña Teresa and the Chicken. The wooden house in Castañer, didn't come with air conditioner or anything cool. The heat, its own kind of music. And so was Abuela, demanding, sharp-tongued, the kind of woman I imagine whose teeth grew in because she told them to. So the chicken never had a chance. It ran around the backyard flapping its black feathered wings for mercy, for God's attention. But Papa Dios knew better than to get in between a woman feeding her grandkids. I looked over my shoulder, and there she was chasing him like an old lover she came back to haunt, yelling, "Hijo de puta, sinvergüenza, ven acá." Her rosary beads slapped against her chest over and over like a chant, and you knew everything in her path was temporary. Even the wind buckled at the knees at the sight of a woman too wise to act like her blood was softer than it was. And I saw her do it, and I think she knew, because a chicken clucked so hard it spit up its own good throat, and she laughed, grabbed it by the neck, hung it high, swung it high above her head like a propeller. Once she gutted mom's favorite pig with a machete and fed it to her on her 12th birthday. And maybe that's how mama learned to love us, to kill the thing that feeds you. Years later, she didn't go to her best friend's funeral or the vecina who mothered her in New York, barely made it through Abuela's. I suppose all she had was to love until death and no more. So when we saw Doña Teresa lying in the casket, arms crossed, chin cocked up, the whole family cried and clawed, wanting her to come back, wanting her to shout, "Didn't I prepare you better than this?" This next poem borrows its title in part from a New York Times article published like 3 months after Hurricane Maria. Article is called "Making a Crypto Utopia in Puerto Rico." And essentially the piece documented a group of investors from California who had relocated to the island in the direct aftermath of the hurricane. These are investors who saw opportunity where there is devastation. And so one of the things that Mary Ruffel said is that a word's etymology is like his DNA. And so I looked up the DNA, so to speak, of Portopia, and essentially it means door, nowhere. I mentioned earlier that Natalie's poems really explore that tension between the estranged and the beloved. And I think this poem is attempting to do something similar, an island that is both paradise and colony, but certainly not for sale. This poem is dedicated to the organizers who are fighting every day for Puerto Rico that remains serving the people. Portopia. The coquis don't sing anymore. They click. Mosquitoes turn drone. Metropolis of crypto bro. Tax deductible greed. A door opens. An island drowns. A playground emerges. A boy, his toy. Depending on the faith, the most dangerous part of a wealthy man, his index finger. What he points to. Who he lands on. A civilization. Disposable income, pirate in cargo short, new world, old order. Meanwhile, we, diaspora, separated by sea, peel plátanos and cut them on the same angle our mothers taught us to clap when the plane lands on either shore. Now, the beaches are gated and no one knows the names of the dead. Now investors clean their beaks in the river, and this is how a man becomes a flood. Landlord of nothing, king of no good sky. Watch paradise misbehave. Watch the night pearl into a necklace of fists. Watch this El Junque, a real god machine, unhinge her jaw and swallow the flock. Where are the Puerto Ricans, huh? Cuchifrito, ghost town, battery-operated citizenship. An island is not a tarmac. A disaster is not a destination. I'm going to read a new poem that is part of a series of basketball sonnets that I have been working on for quite some time. I'll explain and get into a little bit later about the basketball sonnet series I've been working on. But as someone, Natalie and I both played in college, and I am in awe of all the ways there are so many writers who write about their relationship to basketball or what basketball has made possible. And I've been sitting with building a poetics out of basketball, right? A basketball poetics, and how poetry and basketball and sport, there's so much interconnectedness between the art forms, right? They're both forms of expression that are about what is hidden and what is revealed, right? About creating patterns and then breaking them. This poem is called The Art of Defending the Crossover, or Debunking the Myth that Puerto Rico Needs the United States. Something that has been on my mind for a while is observing the national conversation about Puerto Rico and how paternalistic it is and how misguided it feels. It's not what does Puerto Rico want when it comes to its political status, which has been a large part of the conversation, but rather, well, what do we do with Puerto Rico? What do we want to do with this asset, right? And after Maria, me and my mom were having deeper conversations about this relationship, right? This colonial relationship between the U.S. and this island nation, right? That is in this ambiguous place, this place of no place, politically speaking. And we were talking about, well, who is really benefiting from this relationship? And I remember I was trying to tie the devastation that we were seeing on the news after Maria to specific policies and just a larger historical pattern of exploitation and imposition. And I remember my mom telling me to stop talking about that. I think because there was a real fear in realizing that you've been lied to. That was my sense of it. And Puerto Ricans for decades, centuries, have been brainwashed to think that we cannot govern ourselves. And yet the reality is that it's colonial policies from the US that have undermined PR's political voice and economic power. And I wanted to push back against that. So this poem is called Art of Defending the Crossover, or Debunking the Myth that Puerto Rico Needs the United States. Stay low. Don't believe the shoulders. They lie like two false gods. Will lead you in the wrong direction. Will leave you in limbo. Then have you believing hype and history you didn't write. Will have you sign your life away. Instead, believe the waste. Everything else, optical illusion. Think Jones Act, Operation Bootstrap, the Labor Department's Migration Office. Don't board the ship of shifts. See, the trick to surviving is to never get caught flat-footed, never get caught reaching for something you can't have. This is another basketball sonnet. I have sort of been approaching this series thinking about the sonnet as sort of the perfect container for these kinds of poems, because the sonnet obviously has the volta, right? Like the turn in the poem. And a lot of poets call it the pit, right? A pivot, right? Where the poem pivots. And that's obviously something that is directly related to something we do in basketball, right? We have a pivot foot, right? Which is really about moving in a different direction, right? Gesturing toward a different outcome. So I like to think about not to get too basketball technical here, but the foot that doesn't move as the impetus for the poem, right? That stationary foot. And the other foot is sort of about the exploration or the undoing. This poem is called Lady Jordan. It didn't matter that I married the game or slept with a ball under my arm. Mom said, girls don't hoop, they wear hoops. And around here, vecinas chirped, it's always y tu novio season. But isn't beauty a finger roll, a backdoor cut on the blacktop, a fadeaway jump shot, 2 seconds left on the clock? And there was Danny talking smack, even though his teeth were out of order. This isn't the only history, but is the history of everything. The neighborhood boys who shot crooked never learned my name. So I played them 21, turned their ankles to jello, made their backs kiss the floor until they donned me, Lady Jordan. And who wouldn't take that? Though I've never been ladylike, I wore that rusted metal rim like a ring and slipped my bones through the net like a perfect white dress. All right, I have one more poem for you all. Thank you so much for being a generous audience. And thank you again to Natalie and Andy and Laura and everybody at the Free Library. I'm very excited for Natalie's reading. This last poem I wrote pre-COVID, but it sort of takes on new meaning now that we are having a deeper conversation about who our essential workers are, right? And what kind of work is deemed worthy or important and protected. And typically it's not the people in the C-suites, it's not the CEOs, right, who are most essential. It is the people who pick your fruits and vegetables, who take care of your children, who bag your groceries. And growing up in New York City, street vendors, right, were deeply ingrained in my community, right? These were people that we knew and loved. They were the centerpieces. And yet growing up, the older I got, the more I saw that displacement and gentrification, was affecting them, right? That they were being criminalized. And so this poem is dedicated to the street vendor in my community, particularly the piraguero. The piragua is what some people might call a snow cone. We're obviously going to debate that in this poem a little bit. It's called The Queer Girl's Ode to the Piraguero. And again, thank you so much for having me. Oh, piraguero, my first lover, the only man I ever wanted anything from. I sprinted half blocks for you, got off the bus 2 stops early, took the long way home just to see your rainbow umbrella. Oh, piraguero, candy cool syrup, God. Boricua, Batmobile, wooden cart pushing, bobsled, papi. When the viejitas ask for the 10th time whether I got un novio, the closest name on my tongue was you. Who else made me break my neck in two? Who else gave me so much for a dollar? Who raised hell when they nicknamed your island delicacy snow cone, or worse, shaved ice? I trusted you, the hallelujah work of your bare hands, the dirty white kitchen towel you laid over a fat block of ice. And never once did I ask questions. And when they pushed you off 9th Ave, when you packed up on 96, I only saw you after ball games on 131st and 5th, when the hipsters threw ice in paper cups, added nutmeg and real ingredients like mint leaves, called this an upscale makeover for a poor man's treat. I wanted to shout out, no, leave my man alone. Tell me, who else could turn a blue shopping cart into a 57 Chevy? Or a mom and pop shop, maybe the Elotero on El Centro, the churro ladies by the A train, maybe my mama, once the nanny, who sewed curtains for a couple upstairs, made an office out of her hands. Like my pops, who who cut his saxophone until the velvet flesh of night rearranged the altitude of a palladium dance floor. And then a plump wad of cash, a worn rubber band, a 401k shoebox, which is to say, praise everything we build under the table. The underworld of workers, wielders, America's thumping baseline, the chorus of a country where two for one is the best hook to every good song I know. Like the way you turn my tongue into a red carpet, like the first woman I ever loved. Oh, Piragüero, you winter my whole mouth, you conductor of cool. You're the only one I know, the only one who can govern the thick heat like a DJ scratching a glacier. You make the whole city rock. Thank you so much.
Gracias, Denise. That was beautiful. I think you meant raspada, but I'll let you slide with. We can hash that out later.
Frios and raspados, Dominicans, Mexicans. This is the Latinx diaspora right here, right? We got different names for the same thing.
I wish everyone would put them in the chat. Put whatever you call it in the chat. We'll figure it out later. Mil gracias for having me. It's really lucky to be here with you all. Always to be able to be with Denise. We were kind of talking a little bit about the last time I saw you was Canto Mundo. So Laura, for your work putting this together, the Free Library. So I'm going to read a couple poems. I'm going to read a new poem that I don't quite know how to read yet, but I'm going to kind of read off some of what you did, Denise. So I'll start with They Don't Love You Like I Love You. So this samples the Yeah 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 song Maps, and you'll hear some of the lines, and then a Beyonce, of course. So they don't love you like I love you. My mother said this to me long before Beyonce lifted the lyrics from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And what my mother meant by don't stray was that she knew all about it, the way it feels to need someone to love you, someone not your kind, someone white, someone, some many who live on top of those of ours who don't. I'll say, I'll say, what is the United States if not a clot of clouds, if not spilled milk or blood, if not the place we once were in the millions. America is maps. Maps are ghost white and layered with people and places I see through. My mother has always known best, knew that I'd been begging for them to lay my face against their white laps, to be held in something more than the loud light of their projectors as they flicker themselves sepia or blue all over my body. All this time, I thought my mother said, wait, as in give them a little more time to know your worth. When really she said, wait, meaning heft, preparing me for the yoke of myself, the beast of my country's burdens, which is less worse than my country's plow. Yes, when my mother said, they don't love you like I love you, she meant, Natalie, that doesn't mean you aren't good. I think that's something that I've been thinking a lot about in this book, but just generally, right? I mean, Denise, you're talking a bit about that too, just thinking about like, what is goodness, you know, how we were taught we couldn't be good, that goodness, American goodness, is something that wasn't meant for us. I'm thinking too about, like you were talking about those hands, right? They didn't have soft hands, and yet, the capacity for love in those same hands, I think about my mom's hands a lot. I think also about the way my mother, my mother's scent growing up, right? Like it's always like bleach or like something from the kitchen. And just what a comfort that was. But yeah, so thinking about hands. And thinking too that, you know, every good thing and every bad thing I've done in most cases has started at my hands. So I'm gonna read a poem for that, toward that. These hands, if not God's, haven't they moved like rivers, like glory, like light over the 7 days of your body? And wasn't that good, them at your hips? Isn't this what God felt when he pressed together the first beloved, everything? Fever, vapor, Atman, pulses, finally a sin worth hurting for, a fervor, a sweet, a you are mine. It is hard not to have faith in this. From the blue-brown clay of night, these two potters crushed and smoothed you into being, grind, then curve, built your form up, atlas of bone, fields of muscle, one breast a fig tree, the other a nightingale, both morning and evening. Oh, the beautiful making they do of trigger and carve, suffering and stars. Aren't they too the carpenters of your small church? Have they not burned on the altar of your belly, eaten the bread of your thighs, broke you to wine, to ichor, to nectarious feast? Haven't they riveted your wrists? Haven't they had you at your knees? And when these hands touched your throat, showed you how to take the apple and the rib, how to slip a thumb into your mouth and taste it all, didn't you sing out their 99 names? Zahir, Aleph, hands times seven, Sphinx, Leonid, Locomotora, Rubidium, August and September? And when you cried out, oh, Prometheans, didn't they bring fire? These hands, if not God's, then why, when you have come to me and I have returned you to that from which you came, white mud, mica, mineral, salt, why then do you whisper, oh, my heketonhire, my centimani, my hundred-handed one? You were talking about etymology. I think a lot about etymology. And I think a lot too about what folks expect of us with etymology, and that they believe etymology only comes from the English language. But that you go back in the English language and you meet Spanish, you meet all of our other languages. And then of course the Mojave language. And so, and I work a lot with etymology. And something I always find interesting is when folks think that because I'm using I'm going far back in the language to pull some of these words back to make the obsolete words mean again or feel again, or to hold language to account for some of the really terrible things it's done, or to remind us like, hey, just because you write OBS period obsolete, it doesn't mean that you can ignore what you once did with this word. That there's some kind of expectation that because I am I'm Mojave, and because I'm Latina, Latinx, Mexican, Spanish, like queer, I shouldn't be able to do that. But I love being able to get into the English language and to hold it to account, and also to make it more capacious, because it needs to be more capacious to hold a lot of us. It can't be its least bare bones self. It can't, the ways that we bloom in it, it can no longer be who it thought it was when it first tried to crush us. It's going to have to become more. This next word is like, it's something coming out of an etymological exercise. And so I'm going to use the word colony, which I use a couple times in other poems, but I'm thinking of colony in particular in relationship to migration, because you can't get into the etymology of migration without landing at colony, settlement, alien, all of these kind of words of when they established cities and states and who they could keep out. I'm also thinking a lot with this poem about murdered missing Indigenous women. I'll just leave it at that and I'll go ahead and read. And it works a little bit. It's very narrative. So it's got an almost prose feel to it. And I didn't know this when I began the poem, but a group of rabbits you can call a colony. It's another word for that. So, and I'm also trying to hold the idea or the word whiteness to account, to not let it be a color. Colony. The coyotes on the beach are vacuuming tonight's terrible light with their eyes. They puncture the river sleep with holes of blue-green eyeshine. The river rolls over, awake. The coyotes are baptizing the rabbits, dunking them in the shallow water. The rabbits play dead in the coyotes' mouths, but jolt and cry out when they break the water. The river is cold and they shake, the rabbits. I've never seen a rabbit swim, and no rabbits will swim tonight. The river, because it is the scene of their crimes. The river, because it will clean us of what the rabbits have done. The rabbits are not from here. They come from another territory of night, from a different moon. The rabbits are white, which is not a color, but how fast it twitches. The rabbits disappear our women. Maybe not these rabbits yet, but rabbits like these and soon. White rabbits as call and response, a multiplication. The game where everyone holds hands, then someone squeezes, sends a signal, and everyone sends the same signal they receive. If that game were forever and played by rabbits, rabbits so white their eyes are pink. The rabbits took my cousin. They collapsed her down to a greasy spot somewhere. Like when your brother backs the truck out of the driveway and the truck leaves behind an iridescent liqueur on the ground. So you sprinkle sand over it to absorb the stain. The coyotes are a night shift, a labor of shades against the pebbled shore. They are a range of blue-black mountains reorganizing weight, a dusk. With more night happening, the rabbits become stranger. Their ears are slicked back like men. I try not to ask myself, what is a rabbit? I can't explain the rabbit, but I feel it. I've felt it my entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. I don't know what it is, but it's there, a white blot in my mind. The question distracts me, and a rabbit kicks its body free. The noisy shadow tangles and disrupts the coyote's feet. One of the coyotes transforms. It opens all of its mouths and recaptures the rabbit. At first, the cry of a rabbit is the cry of a baby. Then the cry becomes something there are no words for. The cry of a rabbit will make you cry, unless you are hungry. Or the rabbit has pulled your cousin out of your life by her hair. The coyotes plunge the rabbits into the river four times. One of the rabbit's ears flap in the wind like empty violet shirt sleeves. Each time they are sunk in the water, the rabbits become more quiet. The silence embers the coyote's eyes copper, chrysocolla. Some of the rabbits hang upside down, staring off and soothed by the moon, who is also soaked with river and whose light trickles out from the middle of the water to the shore in tremors. Wounds move this same drenched way. The mesquite trees along the jetty are tap-rooted in the water. When you gash a mesquite trunk or cut its branches, its skin seeps red-gold sap, weeps and crusts an amber blister. The rabbits wish to begin healing, but their wounds are happening now. The rabbits wish to cicatrix. Rabbits are always too late. The rabbits' cries have become choked with water or the coyote's teeth, most likely with blood and fur, a burbling. The river and its bullfrogs are also sounds. A fish leaps from the water and falls back into it. I should have said the rabbits were screaming, not crying. I am the one crying, and on nights like this, everything is wet as tears. The coyotes move in a group. How mourners move around a pyre, how authorities move to the door of a family whose daughter or mother has gone missing. Not a tight pack, but a breathing. How fingers brush one another on their own hand. The coyotes' tails are down. The rabbits aren't saying anything anymore. They were another kind of quiet before this, before the screaming. The rabbits have never wanted to talk about what they have done. This rabbit quiet is a new quiet. Tufts of pale fur rock in a foam onto the shore, then off, back to, and off again. It never settles. The coyotes clean the rabbits with the river and clean us of the rabbits. They lick the terrible light from one another's faces and eyes. But what the rabbits have done is still done. The coyotes know this and cry the spilling moonlight back to the moon. The moon crusts and closes. The coyotes leave the beach one at a time. We are all clean and lonely. And then I will end with a basketball poem. Run and gun. I learned to play ball on the res, on outdoor courts where the sky was our ceiling. Only a tribal kid shot has an arc made of sky. We balled in the res park against a tagged backboard with a chain for a net, where I watched a wallapai boy from Peach Springs dunk the ball in a pair of flip-flops and slip on the slick concrete to land on his wrist, his radius fractured and ripped up through his skin like a tusk, which didn't stop him from pumping his other still beautiful arm into the air and yelling, "Yeah, Clyde the Glide, motherfuckers," before some adult sped him off to the emergency room. I ran games in the abandoned schoolyard with an 8-foot fence we had to hop, where I tore so many pairs of shorts on the top spikes, and where when my little brother got snagged trying to climb down, my cousin and I let him hang by the waistband of his underwear for an entire game of 11. And if that cousin hadn't overdosed on heroin a few years later, he might have proved us right and been the first res jump man. I got run by my older brother on our slanted driveway, the same brother I write about now, who taught me that there is nothing easy in our desert, who blocked every shot I ever took against him until I was about 12 years old. By then, his addictions had stolen his game while I found mine. I learned the game with my brothers and cousins, with my friends and enemies. We had jacked up shoes and mismatched socks. Our knees were scabbed and we licked our lips chapped. We were small, but we learned to play big enough to beat the bigger, older white kids at the rec center on the hill, which to get to, we crossed underneath the I-40 freeway across the train tracks and through a big sandy wash. We played bigger and bigger until we began winning. And we won by doing what all Indians before us had done against their bigger, whiter opponents. We became coyotes and rivers, and we ran faster than their fancy kicks could up and down the court. Game after game, we became the weather. We blew by them. We rained buckets. We lit up the gym with our moves. We learned something that was more important than fist, at least at that age. We learned to make guns of our hands, and we pulled the trigger on jumpers all damn day. And when they talked about the way we played, they called it run and gun. And it made them tired before they ever stepped on the court. Just thinking about a pickup game against us made the white boys from the junior high and high school teams go to sleep. And while they slept, we played our dreams. I'll stop right there. I'll stop and meet you at the court right there.
Thank you both so much for those really powerful readings. I'm grateful to be in your audience tonight. I'm going to start with a really pretty heavy question from the audience. I think it's a good place to start. Would you please talk more about etymology and braiding your languages and how you make the poems sing? How did you come up with your reading styles? Killer readings.
That's a great question. I think for a long time, the poetry that I was exposed to in public school did not reflect my language. And so I was talked out of poetry, even though poetry is something that like I came from. I just didn't know it. And so I think for me, it was more so feeling permissioned and feeling like anything and everything was accessible to me. And the ways in which I and my family bends and blends language, like it's a language is a moving thing, you know? And the ways in which we bend and blend language, whether that's Spanglish or other iterations or permutations or combinations of languages, I think I wanted to bring that to my poetry. And so it wasn't something I was trying on like an outfit, but more so just being more embodied in a way where I didn't feel like I had to shapeshift in any way. I actually just took a workshop with Ellen Bass on music, and Patricia Smith just gave an incredible talk about music. And you know, my dad is a Latin jazz musician. He played for Tito Puente for like 30 years. And so like the music we listened to in my house, the concerts I went to as a young kid, the studio sessions that I just sat in, right? Like, even though I'm not fluent in Spanish, I'm conversational. I had an appreciation for the way in which like the weather of language, the temperature of language could make you cry, could make you feel something. That to me, like language and performance is just an internal rhythm externalized. You know, it is the body of the poem externalized, right? And like, I am so drawn to that. I think that's what attracts kids to poetry. I think that's what attracts so many of us to listen to things that otherwise we may not listen to, right? Is that musicality that is disarming. It's the way that humor is disarming. But also to me, when I think about music, I think about repetition, the repetition, like on a syllabic level, right? Whether you're talking about syntax or you're talking about anaphora, like how repetition is about an undoing. Like Douglas Kearney always like has an incredible essay on repetition. And he quotes Suzanne Laurie Parks, who says, what does it mean to say the same thing twice? You're not saying the same thing, right? So I think about how the musicality of language is both something that draws you in, but also, again, we talk about pattern breaking. Like it is something that is a survival tool, right? I think to undo and to point a finger sometimes when a finger needs to be pointed, right? Or to open a door when a door needs to be opened, or to pull a lover close. I think the musicality of language is something, a tool that I think is really useful.
Yeah, that's a great answer. I mean, it's a generous answer. I can move around in it. Yeah, and I mean, I think just something to add, like it's not a lot different than basketball. It's physical. I think we find all kinds of ways of the physicality of language. I think we're denied it because the bifurcation of what is intellectual versus what is body, which I wasn't raised with that. That's the same for me. And so that feels lucky. And I think one of the luckiest things for me with language is that it is another way of touch. That's the way I experience it. And I think there's also something important about opening that space for folks who are not like eye-centric or ear-centric or centered, you know? So what does that mean that we're communicating one body to another? You know, what if we get away from meaning and think about how we feel, right? And it's the same thing with basketball. It's momentum. It's about saying like, how do I enter this stream of energy, or when do I need to pull back, or how do I hold up against it? And, you know, etymology is related to the origin of words, right? And which is similar and right to our names. Like, how'd you get your name? You know, like, that's a great story always. Like, how'd you get your name? And it's something that I think the English language denies a lot of us who have other languages. And like the idea of having many origins is extremely important, right? Like we have to be able to originate. If not, most of us would only be held to whoever told us what our wounds were, right? We wouldn't be able to have multiple origins to keep becoming and becoming and becoming. And so, for me, that's kind of the way that language works for me. It's physical. It feels old and it feels brand new each time. And in Mojave way of thinking, every time you say something, it's new. It's a new energy. What I'm saying right now is out and I'll never get it back, which is why it's so dangerous, right? Which is why words should mean many things, you know, because, you know, once we pin them down and they become knowledge, that's when I think we stop imagining. It's like, I know this. You know, I want to know as little as I can because I feel like where living happens is outside of that knowing. It's the what if like a leaf blooms, you know, what if I touch someone, what if I hold myself, you know? So I think, I guess, language very physically to have a more efficient answer.
Thank you so much. Excuse me. The next one, this is another question for both of you. I hear whole stories in your lines and wondered how many ways you've thought of telling those stories and thereby drawing in wider audiences for your work. Are you considering memoir, more essays, fiction, hybrid work, or collaborations with photographers, musicians, filmmakers, playwrights, etc.?
I think for me, I always love collaborating with other artists and other art forms. I love hearing how dancers think about an image or building an image. I love the way that musicians think about language and build rhythmic language. And so I got a reading right before the pandemic where her name is Cosmic Jackie. She told me to think about my work in more of a multimedia way. And I don't know, obviously these basketball sonnets, I'm intending them to be part of my manuscript, but I also am really interested in how they could live paired with photographs. I've been like staring at basketball rims. I'm so fascinated by every time I drive by a court, like the little distinctions between them and the stories that the rim or the backboard or the court can tell. So, I don't know that I can say anything other than I hope to just deeply listen to what the work is asking of me and be open to how they might live. YA is really interesting to me. Theater is really interesting to me. And I think photography and that the way that imagery, photography and film can sort of create another body of work by its interaction with whatever it is that I'm offering. So yes, I'm open to all of it.
Yeah, sometimes poetry, the least of poetry is the page, right? And that feels lucky. I maybe this too comes, Denise, from like playing basketball. I know for me, it also comes from being in a big family, but I think better, I'm more like sensual in a group. Like that's just the way my brain was made. Like I have from a big chaotic family, everybody's talking. Like if you're my friend, you have to be like willing to let me, like I don't consider it interruption. I just consider it like excitement and I jump in. And like, so if you're my friend and we're gonna make it as friends, you have to be willing to like realize I'm not like trying to get in your way, but I just expect you to keep going right after me. You know? And so, I mean, I feel like I write like that. I feel like I feel that physicality, that momentum, that shifting, that give and take in your work as well. And something, I'll just share this small thing because, I mean, it's so very different to be sitting and reading a poem. It's not something I'd ever done before this pandemic situation and being on Zoom. And like, I had to stop because, I make so much noise. And so I kept getting like, people were like, hey, Natalie, like you're moving, you can't move your papers. but your body, right? And like, I mean, I'm not even I've never been on a spoken word stage. So that's a very different way of moving your body. But I have been collaborating with some performance artists, and in one performance, this really incredible artist, Indigenous artist, Maria Hupfield, who is based in New York and has now jumped up to Toronto. But we were collaborating on this performance, and somehow we didn't plan it, but I ended up doing the movements and she ended up doing most of the talking, which is a little bit unlike that. And so I found myself in the middle of this room in a way I'd never been like panoramaed, right? Like you can stand in the front of the room, that's one thing. But I was in the middle of this room doing these movements. And after like the next day, I hadn't been that sore in so long, because like it made my body different in that space. And I think for me with collaborations, that's something that feels really important to me is the different sensualities that happen across these spaces, you know, even thinking about like the image, you know, what the image does. But yeah, I mean, the collaborative, I think it's very natural for poetry. I think sometimes it's scary, of course, right? Like anything. But I think most artists I know, I think, read poetry. And so in some ways, if all we're doing is poetry, maybe we're not doing enough.
Thank you both so much. This, I think, is going to have to be our last question. Does your imaginative language come from the language used in the environment in your upbringing? Or did you acquire it as a necessity to describe your poems that hold nature, shape-shifting mythology, and culture?
I think maybe a little bit of both. I want to sit with that and live inside that. That feels like a living question. I like that. I think a little bit of both. I think, creating language, I don't know if I would say acquire, right? But creating language feels like a necessity, right? Natalie was talking about sort of in another way, like the narrative that we inherit about ourselves, right? The words that we inherit about ourselves that are attached to us in the larger, right? Like dominant narrative, whatever that may be. And that it is important to subvert that in whatever ways with the tools that we have, and language is our tool. And words are my tool. And so I feel like that is, from my earliest memories, you know, we've been talking about basketball tonight, but having the ability to turn a phrase or to disarm a violence, right? Or potential violence that could happen, right? Or to be able to bend language in a way that gets you out of a situation, right? So I feel like I've had practice, like there are so many ways I've had practice with poetry before I started writing poetry. And for me, the imagination is critical in that, to be able to dream outside of the box that you inherited, which is very, very, very small. And so I think it, but it also comes from the language in my environment too, like without thinking about it. Sometimes when I read poems and I use a lot of alliteration, I can hear my foot hit the, you know, when you're walking in New York City next to the delis, they have the grates, the doors, the metal doors to the basement where they store food. Like I can hear that particular sound every time I use alliteration, or like hard consonants. I can see my mother's face when I use like a speculative conjunction. Do you know what I mean? Like not to get all languagey and nerdy about it, but like, I think it, and then on an emotional, like, level, just what's in my bones. You know, it makes me kind of think of something that Rosie Perez said in a New York Times interview, like, I can teach you how to dance, but I can't teach you how to boogie, which is like the best answer I could give to think about voice and like creativity, you know? I think it's a combination for me.
Yeah, I would say the same. And I think there's also, I mean, I do think that like language is one of our technologies of touch. It's not the body. The body makes it. It's not the body, but it's the way the body reaches out, for example, or it's the way the body takes in or holds back, right? It's the body's desire or fear or something, right? In a kind of language, we say body language, right? It's all the ways, and it, you know, it begins, and of course, in a very self-centered place, but it's meant for what happens outside. Like, you know, I think of language in some ways a little bit like a window. And I think for folks like I tell my students a lot, like when you're thinking about like language and intentionality, like it's important to know what your verbs are. Like what makes you electric? What actuates the world, you know? So I think a lot in terms of the imagination about the verb. And in my language, for example, this example I always use is that like the chair only exists because it's what our body does, you know? So like, there's not really a chair, but there's what the body does. You know, it's the same thing that with the, like, we don't say walk. We have no generic for walk, but we say how you are walking or where you are coming from. So I think about language as being a kind of imagination, you know, and then the strange part is, right, like what's happening in my head versus what becomes spoken or signed or, you know, written with text. And just like, I think that, like one of the ways I want to answer this too is about like emotionality and sensuality. So like an example that I use often is like, just for example, like what do you call like this part of your body? Like, what do you call this right here? It's like, okay. So like Denise, how do you call that part of the body?
Like your stomach area?
Yeah. So stomach.
Like stomach, yeah. Midsection.
Midsection. Laura, what would you call it?
I would have said stomach too.
Stomach. So like maybe you would say like barriga, or maybe you would say panza, or maybe you would say belly. Like belly, what can be hungrier, a stomach or a belly, you know? Or like if you say like torso, maybe that feels muscular, or abdomen, maybe that feels medical. But like in Mojave, so this is about like languaging the imagination, like the way that I imagine my body because of my language, so that the language happened first, right? Or maybe the, you know, like where does it happen? Is that we say ito, which means the center, but it's our same word for heaven. Because when white folks came and they were pointing and they're like, what do you call that? What do you call that? And we're like, I don't know. Like we didn't even have a word for sky. Our word for sky is up. Cause we're like, it's not, there's nothing there, right? Like it's this other world. But so when they asked us to translate, we said, okay, that's the middle. So it became like what they said was heaven is also what we say for stomach. And so like it's a lucky, generous space to exist, is that I can hold whatever people think heaven is and the center of my own body in this kind of emotional and intellectual, like there's a weight to it. And so thinking of language, I think that's something I think a lot about, is that it can be prophetic, right? Like it, yes, it carries with it everything it's done, but it can also be prophetic, which is why it's dangerous. Like when we say who we might yet be, that is like a great power against what they've told us we are, right? And so, yeah, so I think of it like I think, Denise, this is like you're saying this too. It's becoming, you know, it should shift. It should change. Like, what does it mean to say love and then to call out to your lover, hey, love, that's different. Or amor, you know, like, so I think there's something really lucky about this question that you've asked us, and maybe that we always want to ask. And so the last thing, if I can just hop in and just ask both of you, like, it's a question I've been asking my friends and strangers, but like, what's the word you need right now, like to live, to be? So is there a word or like a phrase or a couple words that just right now to you feel essential, like to your days? Mm. That would be lucky for me to be able to leave on that.
I would say beloved. That to me is a word I want to live in. The beloved, a beloved, right? To live inside of the beloved, something that you cherish. Intimacy, recognition, the stuff of poetry. I would say that word for me. I love that question.
I'm happy to answer that one as well. I, for me right now, I'm going to choose the word presence because at this time, you're in so many places at so many different times, and you're a homeschool teacher and you're working at the library and running a home and just trying to be present in all of them at the same time. And to that end, I want to thank you both so much for your strong, beautiful readings and also for your thoughtful answers to our questions. And to our audience, thank you so much for keeping us company and for being engaged and for asking these questions. It's just so heartwarming to know that poetry is alive and well at the Free Library of Philadelphia. So thank you all for joining us tonight and have a good night. Goodbye.
Gracias. Dream well, everybody. Ciao, ciao.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.